John McClellan was going to stop Thurgood Marshall. He simply could not imagine the likes of Marshall on the U.S. Supreme Court, so he convinced himself he could prevent it. He was Senator John McClellan, and he was powerful, and people feared him. He had a hard face, a dead ringer for the comic Jack Benny if Benny had been dipped in plaster, and a hard, scratchy voice. He wore horn-rimmed glasses, from which time and again during previous hearings while sitting in judgment of others, he peered down on witnesses with menacing glares. He combed his hair straight back in a severe manner. McClellan was one of the Senate barons, men who had served for years and seemed to have grown out of the very building that housed the U.S. Senate. He loathed small talk and abhorred social teas and the like, which many senators and their wives seemed to enjoy. Even when his Arkansas constituents visited his Washington office, he seemed impatient, as if he wished they could state their business as fast as possible and be on their way. He'd shoot an aide that look, and then the aide would begin motioning toward the door, and McClellan would toss final words at his guests.
"Thanks for coming by. Say hi to the folks back home. Don't forget to take a souvenir."
He had been sent to Washington by Arkansas voters, first as a congressman in 1934, and then in 1942 as a U.S. senator. And now he found himself with a coveted seat on the powerful Senate Judiciary Committee. He told his aides to start digging. He wanted as much information on Thurgood Marshall as he could get, and he wanted it as fast as he could get it. John McClellan looked upon himself as a force for good, standing between Thurgood Marshall and the Supreme Court of the United States of America. In Washington, McClellan prided himself on his activities, his constant motion. At one time, he sat on 14 subcommittees. In 1954, he found himself on a committee with the Wisconsin Senator Joseph McCarthy, who was galloping around the nation's capital on a one-man witch hunt for communists. McCarthy had charged the State Department with having dozens of communists in its employ. At a time when Americans were fearful of communism, McCarthy's charges landed him on the front pages. Many were riled up. All of this intrigued McClellan, as ready as anyone to corral a communist. But McCarthy, who was a shambling and reckless figure, soon made McClellan nervous. It was McCarthy's lack of discipline and some of his aides who were so utterly unprofessional.
"I'm fond of Joe McCarthy," McClellan allowed, "but he's getting out of hand and we have to do something to control him."
McClellan quit the McCarthy-led committee he was on. He escaped the shadow of McCarthy with prescient timing, as the Army-McCarthy hearings, nationally televised, exposed McCarthy as a mean-spirited liar. The Senate eventually censured him. In 1957, McClellan led the celebrated Senate Labor Rackets Committee, which took on mobsters and their henchmen, and eventually exposed the criminal underworld in America. That was the moment that John McClellan's profile rose in America. Because of disclosures exposed by his committee, two Teamsters, Jimmy Hoffa and Dave Beck, had been sent to prison. Another round of hearings in 1963 offered up Joseph Valachi, a mobster who seemed to thrill television viewers with his insider's account of cold-blooded doings in the mafia. The Omaha World-Herald had once said of McClellan that he possessed a steely mask of Old Testament righteousness. If John McClellan had stopped gangsters, he figured he could certainly thwart LBJ's new Supreme Court nominee. In Washington, they didn't bother to refer to him as Senator McClellan. They called him the chairman, because he had been chairman of the Senate Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations, as well as chairman of the Senate Select Committee on Improper Activities in the Labor or Management Field, which was the committee that provided him with the tools to go after the mobsters. Because those racketeering hearings were nationally televised, everyone knew Senator John McClellan. The young aides in the Johnson White House knew well how dangerous McClellan could be to their efforts in getting Thurgood Marshall onto the U.S. Supreme Court. Virtually every speech he made inscribed a rising curve from the prudent statement of fact to polemical rage, his powerful voice quavering with indignation, is how the Johnson aide Harry McPherson put it. The Johnson administration had drawn a battle line. Thurgood Marshall was the lawyer who had won the Brown v. Board of Education ruling, a ruling that led to utter embarrassment in McClellan's home state in the fall of 1957, when 9 Negro schoolchildren had tried to desegregate Little Rock Central High School and been stopped by whites hurling epithets, spit, and large rocks. It was also the year that Time magazine named McClellan its Man of the Year. Reporters on the scene to cover the story were chased and bloodied by the mobs. This had forced President Dwight Eisenhower to go into military mode and dispatch troops to protect the children. The troops had to remain at the school, watching over the Negro children for an entire year. Little Rock was thus seared into the nation's psyche as mean and bigoted. And on his trips back home to Arkansas at the time, to attend all those social events and grand openings and visit family, as all politicians do, John McClellan had to endure all the chatter about Little Rock, about how the government was attacking states' rights, how Negroes were trying to take over the schools. And all he could do was assure his constituents that he was doing everything he could to protect their way of life, the Southern way of life. It made McClellan angry, though, how he had to take up all of his time defending himself and how hard he was working in Washington to keep Arkansas as it always had been. Thurgood Marshall, if he made it to the Supreme Court, was not going to keep Arkansas as it had always been.